Well, good morning. This is Per Fagren, KBOO News and Public Affairs. Another installment of Fight the Empire, or I guess you can use any first word you choose, you know. Anyway, I was going to be doing this show with Scott Forrester, but Scott, as turned out, he has filed as a candidate for a seat in the State House of Representatives from his Gresham district. And KBOO has a rule that candidates for public office cannot be an air room personality or a host or whatever. You know, I guess they can be guests, but of course if you have one candidate on a show, then others can demand equal time. So anyway, Scott will be doing his campaigning until the May primary, and then if he wins that, then he gets to run against the incumbent out there. So anyway, that's why Scott is not on the show today. And wish him all success. We need voices like him down in Salem, I'll tell you that. Anyway, the show is going to be about Haiti. And it was going to be sort of the intersection of empire and the environment. And how one affects the other. And sort of, to me, Haiti is sort of a horrible example of what the empire can do to, you know, to a nation and a people. Haiti is sort of, it occupies the island of Hispaniola. It shares that island with the Dominican Republic. And it was one of the islands where Columbus landed. It was populated by the Arawak Indians, who wasn't very long before the Arawak Indians were no more. They were no more. They were brutalized, killed by disease, forced labor, and various other things. And the island Haiti became the colony, the French colony of Saint-Domingue. And it was once France's richest colony. It was covered with huge forests and rich land. It produced sugar, coffee, cotton, indigo, which is very valuable in those days, maybe still is, and tobacco. It actually produced two-thirds of France's gross national product. And this is all produced by 500,000 slaves. In other words, the French economy literally depended for its life on the labor of 500,000 slaves. Well, beginning in 1791, there was a slave rebellion led by a coachman named Toussaint Louverture. And he defeated the armies, not all at once, but in succession, he defeated the armies of Spain, Great Britain, and Napoleonic France. The U.S. at that time, and this is after our own revolution, the U.S. aided the French army with $400,000, which is a lot of money in those days. Now, this happened when Napoleon was ruling France, so it was in the early 1800s, probably under President Thomas Jefferson. And Toussaint Louverture was captured during so-called peace negotiations, and he was whisked off to France, where he died in a French prison. In 1804, Haiti gained its independence, and its first leader was Jean-Jacques Dessalines, who was murdered by the Creole elite in an attempted coup. Now, the Creole elites, rather generally the lighter-skinned people who were born in Haiti. They were not they didn't derive from France. They were born in Haiti, but they were generally either white or light-skinned black people, and they were the people who ruled this sort of independent, or tried to rule this newly independent country. Well, 1804, this was the first successful, perhaps the only successful slave rebellion in the Western Hemisphere. Thomas Jefferson was afraid that this slave revolt would come to the U.S. Remember that Thomas Jefferson, besides being a founding godfather, was also a slave owner, which we know a lot about. And he was afraid the slave revolt would spread, and he wanted to, quote, in his own words, confine the plague to the island. That was Thomas Jefferson. And Napoleon Bonaparte, in his own words, he said, this is he said, quote, the freedom of the Negroes, if recognized in Saint Domingue by France, would at all times be a rallying point for freedom seekers in the New World. Well, Napoleon had it right, and he didn't like that. And so he sent 22,000 soldiers, which was the largest force to ever cross the Atlantic at that time, to recapture Haiti. Well, he failed. And so Haiti was, right away after they gained their independence, they were stuck with it was 60 years before the U.S. ever recognized Haiti. So in 1804 is when Haiti gained independence. 60 years later, around the time of our own Civil War, the U.S. Recognized the government of Haiti. And probably the reason for it is this, that in 1825, the French forced Haiti to take on a debt of 150 million francs to repay the former slave owners for their lost property. Now, the lost property could include land, but it would also include their lost slaves. So 150 million francs, which today would be worth about $21.7 billion. So this is something we might keep in mind when you hear, you know, in today's controversy over reparations for slavery, that Haiti was sort of forced to make reparations for being free. Haiti paid its first installment of 30 million francs by closing every school in the country. So this kind of sets, this is another first in a way. What happens when a supposedly free country is enslaved by debt? I don't know if people remember, we talked a couple times with John Perkins, who wrote a book called Confessions of an Economic Hitman, about how he went around to third world countries and persuaded their leaders to take on debts that would never be repaid, which would keep that country in permanent bondage. And this began back in almost 200 years ago with Haiti. Their last payment was made in 1947 to the United States, which had bought Haiti's debt during the 1915-1934 occupation. The Marines landed in 1915, and one of their first acts was to take over the customs house, which, of course, collects tariff duties and things like that, and also to suspend the salary of the president of Haiti until he signs over the Bank of the Nation, which became a branch of Citibank of New York, which I believe is the Rockefeller's bank. And the U.S. and the Marines left, they landed in 1915 and they stayed until 1934. And when they left, they kind of left behind a compliant government. You know, they'd already taken they'd taken the Bank of the Nation. Anyway, in 1957, from 1957 to 1986, Haiti was ruled by François Papadoc Duvalier. He actually was a country doctor. And his son, Jean-Claude Baby Doc. And they, this was basically 30 years of really brutal rule. They had the Papa Doc started his own kind of private death squad known as a Tonton Macoute. who went around killing people in broad daylight. They had absolute impunity. They could do whatever they wanted. And the U.S. Got along fine with Papa Doc and his son, Baby Doc. Finally, in 1986, an uprising overthrew Baby Doc, who was really not really cut out to be a ruthless ruler. He tried to be. The U.S. Air Force flew him to France in a comfortable exile. The very next day, February 8th of 1986, the U.S. unloaded a lot of arms and ammunition at Port-au-Prince Airport, which is probably destined for the Tonton Macoute, who stayed behind and continued their rampage. In fact, in November of 1987, the Army and the death squads killed 34 people in an election. And the winner, or whoever became president, was a man named Leslie Francois Manigat. He became president, and he was overthrown 4 months later in early 1988. Well, they had another election in 1990, and the U.S. backed a gentleman named Marc Bazin, who was a former World Bank official, and he looked like just the kind of candidate the United States wanted. But lo and behold, a priest named Jean-Bertrand Aristide won the election with 66% of the vote. He was very popular with the poor people of Haiti, of whom there are many, and his party was called Lavalas, which is a Creole word for flash flood. Well, he swept into power with 66% of the vote, but he didn't stay around very long because he was overthrown after 7 months in office. There was a group called the Front pour l'Avancement et le Progrès de Haïti, the Front for the Advancement and Progress of Haiti, which its initials spelled FRAPH, or F-R-A-P-H. And FRAPH was sort of the successor to the Tonton Macoute, probably very much the same people. And FRAPH trafficked in drugs and in a short time, they murdered between 4,000 and 5,000 people. Thousands of people fled Haiti. Many of them went over the border into the Dominican Republic, where they were very ill-treated. They were used as virtual serfs in the Dominican Republic. Others built little boats, and they many of them, thousands of these Haitian boat people, reached the United States. And unlike the Cubans who fled in boats, they were not well received. The United States has this sort of understanding with the Cuban boat people that they can set one foot on U.S. shores and they become political refugees. Not so with the Haitians. They have a real hard time staying in this country, they certainly don't get the all the various benefits that are showered on the Cuban exiles in Florida. In fact, many of them get put in prisons. So this was kind of an embarrassment to the United States, all these boat people arriving, and the U.S. didn't quite know what to do with them. And so in 1994, President Bill Clinton sent 20,000 troops to Haiti to put Aristide back in power, which he did, but he was on a kind of what we call a short leash. He was forced to follow a program of globalizing, which was essentially the program of Marc Bazin, the man that he defeated. But this was the program of what they call the Washington Consensus. And basically, it meant to, sell off state-owned properties, the whole neoliberal free market philosophy. The U.S., in return, promised to disarm the army and froth, but it didn't fulfill that promise. In fact, what it did, one thing the U.S. did at that time was confiscate 160,000 documents that told about United States activities in Haiti. U.S. didn't want those activities made public in any way, so they were taken out of there, and I think to this day they remain secret. So Aristide is back. He served out the rest of his term on this short leash. He did things that a lot of people, he was kind of forced to go along with the World Bank's program. I think he's been criticized by a lot of leftists for that, for opening up a free trade zone on the border of the Dominican Republic. But you might ask, what else could he do? He did do things like raise the minimum wage, which was pitifully low and became a little less pitifully low. And he opened up a medical school and things like that. So in 1995, there was another election, and this was won by René Préval, who got 88% of the vote. Préval was an ally of Aristide. The Haitian Constitution says that a president is limited to one, can only serve one term, no two consecutive terms. You can serve one term, and then you're out, at least temporarily. So René Préval won in 1995, and he tried to run the country much in the same way that Aristide did. And then in the year 2000, Aristide was allowed to run, and he won in a landslide election. And what happened then was the U.S. used its veto in the Inter-American Development Bank to block loans that would provide health care and clean drinking water to Haiti. In other words, this kind of economic embargo. There would be no aid to Haiti, even though it had two elected presidents in a row. So the U.S. blocked these loans from the Inter-American Development Bank, but then the bank turned around and told Haiti that it would have to pay 0.5%, that's half of 1%, credit commission. And so by March 2001, Haiti owed $185,000 as a commission for loans that it never got. Meanwhile, President Jean-Bertrand Aristide called for France to repay that $21 billion that it extorted from Haiti back in the old days to repay the slave owners. And this really got France highly ticked off. This came back to haunt Aristide. In July 2001, so that is just a few months later, a former police officer and death squad leader named Guy Philippe began raids into Haiti from the Dominican Republic, which sort of allowed these raids to continue, did nothing to stop them. I guess Haiti and the Dominican Republic have not always had any kind of a good relationship. The Dominican Republic is generally Spanish speaking, and it's run by, you have elections there, more or less. There was one election in the Dominican Republic where a politician named Juan Bosch won, and he was kind of forced out of office by the U.S., And the U.S. sent troops to the Dominican Republic, too. That was under President Lyndon Johnson. And since then, as far as I know, the Dominican Republic has generally went along with the U.S. program. So Guy Philippe is raiding Haiti from the Dominican Republic, but these were more than just little small raids. He actually attacked the presidential palace and a hydroelectric dam at Peligre in Haiti. Then in January of 2003, Canada's minister of what they call La Francophonie, which is sort of the French-speaking part of the world, they have a minister dealing with that part of the world, sort of like their former colonies, a gentleman named Denis Paradis, convened a meeting of the U.S., French, and Canadian officials in Ottawa. And this meeting was to discuss Aristide's possible removal and replacement. And what they had in mind was some kind of a U.N. trusteeship, similar to what is had happened in Kosovo. So in February 2004, this attempted coup began. You know, it went from raids to a real invasion. And the the rebel troops landed. One of the things that Aristide had done was abolish the Haitian army. And, well, they kind of regrouped and came back in under Guy Philippe. And this rebellion has started kind of in the north, and as it moved south, it kind of faltered. To bail it out, Canadian Special Forces and the U.S. Marines went in the capital city of Port-au-Prince, and they took Aristide out of the palace, and they put him on a plane for the Central African Republic. They said that that if he stayed in the palace, he would undoubtedly be killed by these rebels, which is, may not have been true, but that's what they said. And they also said that they would not be able to defend him. So they kind of hustled him on a plane for Africa. The Central African Republic is really a pretty isolated nation in Africa. Eventually, Aristide was able to go to South Africa, where he was welcomed. In the meantime, a gentleman named Gerard Latortue was installed as president. Now, this was illegal, according to many people, because Latortue had not lived in Haiti for years. He was a Florida businessman. And under Latortue, many people were arrested, including Prime Minister Yvonne Neptune, who is still in prison and on a hunger strike, Father Gerard Jean-Just, who has since been released from prison to be treated for leukemia, and a very well-known popular singer known as Soane. Aristide had built a medical school at Tabar, which provided free education to 247 students. Well, the U.S. shut it down to turn it into a barracks for its troops, and it was now used by, after the U.S. pulled its troops out, they were replaced by this U.N. contingent, and so the old medical school was used by the Brazilian U.N. contingent. New elections are supposed to be held, according to Haiti's constitution. But these elections were postponed four times. Anyway, despite lots of attempts at fraud, René Préval won that election in the first round. There was a lot of finagling going on, burnt and stolen ballots. If Préval had gotten 50% plus one of the vote, he would have been president without having to have a runoff. But the people in charge kind of fudged the election and claiming that he had something like 49%, so he would have to face a runoff against the next runner-up. Well, right around that time, people discovered a whole bunch of burned ballots in a dump in Port-au-Prince. And so they took to the streets and demanding that Préval take office. And so he was declared the winner. And now he still can't take office because the Constitution says they have to elect a parliament to install him. But the elections for parliament have been postponed. So that is where we are right now. Préval won the election. He is the president-elect. But because the elections for parliament have been postponed, he is not able to take office. So apparently Gérard Latortue is still the sort of official president. The economy of Haiti is based on sweatshop labor. There are all kinds of little sweatshops run by the Creole elites of Haiti, some of whom are very prominent in the opposition to Aristide. Haitian farmers are in a kind of a sad state because they're unable to compete with the U.S. subsidized farmers. Haiti was forced to abolish its rice tariff, so people are essentially fed on handouts from the U.S. And subsidized frozen chicken parts from the U.S. One very interesting thing that happened with the Haitian farmers, this is the famous Creole pig episode. This happened in 1982. Haitian pigs were very well suited to the environment. They were lean, and they could eat anything. And they were regarded, poor peasants regarded having a pig is kind of like a bank. You know, you have this this animal that eats anything, and you can it's your dinner. It's you can grow more pigs, and it keeps you from starving. Well, there was an outbreak of African swine fever, and there was a big scare about that. So the U.S. sort of had the Haitian pigs slaughtered and replaced with pigs donated from Iowa. Well, the pigs from Iowa were very fat. They were used to the Iowa climate. They didn't thrive very well in the tropics. They couldn't eat the food that the Haitian pigs ate. They had to have special kind of pig houses. They, in fact, the pigs lived in better housing conditions than many Haitian peasants. And these pigs were known as the four-footed princes. Well, that whole debacle, it cost $600 million and further ruined the peasant economy. So what we have in Haiti now, as far as the environment goes, their huge problem is deforestation. Forests have been cut down, which leads to soil erosion. Whenever there's a hurricane or a heavy rain, soil washes off these bare mountains into the sea. Haitian farmers, they generally own their land, but you can't do much with it. And the deforestation has led to droughts. And so the Haitian environment is really in a sad state. And a lot of this has to do with all the mismanagement and misrule of slavery, colonialism, and this kind of occupation and indirect rule by the United States. So that is where Haiti is right now. And where it goes from here, it's hard to say. Obviously, what they need to do is to rebuild. They need to rebuild their environment. They need to plant trees. They need to restore some kind of agriculture. There's so much that they need to do, but they are still being hampered. They're still being ruled by this UN which sort of represents, ganged up with France, Canada, and the U.S. to keep Haiti in subjugation. And that is where Haiti is now. And this is one thing that is just a real horrible example of what the empire can do to a once very rich and prosperous part of the world. So this is Pierre Fogring. Stay tuned for Art News with Julie Bernard. Stay tuned for Julie Bernard. She's waiting right outside the door, smiling at me. So stay tuned and keep struggling.
You're listening to Thursday Morning Radio Zine on KBOO Portland. Coming up next, Art Focus. Julius Bernard's guest is award-winning ceramic sculptor Patty Woroshina, whose political work is on display at the Contemporary Crafts Museum and Gallery at 11 Democracy Now. Stay tuned for Art Focus.